19 minutes away from 8 o'clock. I'm Bill Small. And as it is Wednesday morning, we are joined by a couple of our chums from the K-State Extension. We've got James Cooper here with us. We've got a Davin Skrantz. Morning, folks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, much to talk about today. And I was just saying earlier that the weather is going to be a little on the cool-ish side for the rest of the week. But then next week, the blast furnace opens up, and we're looking at temps in the mid-90s. I'm sure glad there's no climate change. Anyway, let's start with you, Davin, because you're talking about a very serious subject. There comes a time in the life of every little goat, every little sheep, when it has to start fending for itself. You know, you can't just, as much as the mom would allow that, and you refer to the mother as the dam or the dame, or
That sounds rude.
My damn mom. But, you know, they can. The mother would happily allow their little dammy pie, their little kid, to suckle at the teat, as it were, as long as the little young ones were happy. But that's not good for the baby. The baby needs to fend for itself. And the process of weaning isn't the easiest thing in the world. Not for the little goaty, not for the little kid, not for the little sheepy, not for their moms. How does one proceed in the process of weaning the youngins?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, for folks who aren't familiar with the term weaning, it's when those lambs or kids, or really applies to any type of livestock, is separated from their mom.
Mm-hmm.
So they no
or
longer...
Or their dam.
Yes, if you want to get really formal.
Yeah.
So they're no longer getting milk. Milk is no longer part of their diet. Now, some goats and sheep, or even cows, they will wean their kids or their lambs themselves when they get to a certain age. They'll kick them off, say, you're old enough, kind of, you're grown up now, you're on your own. But a lot of times...
I was 18 when that happened. Graduated high school, get in the Navy, get out of my house.
So weaning age can vary in sheep and goats, and this depends on a number of factors, everything from owner preferences... to maybe if there's some other maybe sort of problem or something else going on where those lambs and kids need to be weaned early. So they can be weaned as early as 14 days all the way to kind of what I mentioned as sort of natural weaning when the mom kicks them off.
I remember those days well.
Yeah, which happens around usually 3 to 4 months of age.
Get off of there.
Yeah. So... early weaning is defined as weaning them prior to 3 months of age. 2 months is the most common. And then late weaning is anything after that. And sheep and goats are ruminants, and that rumen takes a little bit longer to develop. So that's why it's really recommended to wait until they're at least 2 months old to wean them, because then the rumen is developed enough to really process that hay and grass, those forages that will be making up the large part of their diet once they're no longer getting any milk.
So is there any real disadvantage? I mean, you mentioned the development of the rumen. That's the stomach, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not a farm boy by nature. So the benefit of doing it later rather than earlier is they'll have a more developed stomach and they'll be able to process the hay, the grass, whatever. Is there any benefit to doing it earlier at all? I mean, is that why maybe some folks do it earlier?
I wouldn't say necessarily any benefits. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's done earlier. Say if the mom gets sick and she's in poor body condition, maybe she gets pneumonia, comes down with something, then I guess it's kind of not necessarily a pro, but then that's a benefit to weaning early, because then that mom is no longer producing milk to feed the kids, so that extra energy can go back for her putting on weight and feeling better herself.
Yeah.
Another thing that comes into play is if you're raising lambs or kids on a bottle and you're buying milk replacer, weaning them earlier, you don't have to buy milk replacer right. as long, and then you get into some trade-offs there.
Okay, so you said that 2 months was the most common?
Yeah, 2 to 3 months mm-hmm. is the most common, and that's also with sheep and goats. Males reach maturity about 3 to 4 months of age, so you're going to have to separate those males out if they haven't been weathered or castrated to prevent any unwanted breeding there. And then that's also a good age because then you can sell those kids and lambs, and you as the owner won't be out a whole lot of extra money feeding them, unless you want to get right. them to a heavier weight before you sell them, because at that point most of their weight gain has come from nursing off their mom with whatever supplemental grain they happen to get along with the pasture or okay. hay.
I can imagine this must be a very stressful time for little goat children and the little lamb children. Is there any way that the owners, the people who own these things, can, I'm looking for the proper term, that can reduce the stress?
Yeah.
The sheep herd, the goat herd, what yeah. have you.
So they've found that creep feeding kids and lambs can help reduce stress.
All right, now what's creep feeding?
Yeah, great question. So creep feeding is kind of when those lambs and kids sort of have an all-you-can-eat buffet while they're still with their moms.
Now it's, we're talking.
Yeah. It's a feeder set up where those lambs and kids can get in and eat grain. But the moms can't get in there to eat the grain. So mm-hmm. the kids and lambs can come and go, eat the grain whenever they want to, but the adults can't get to it. This also increases the rate of gain, the growth weight of those lambs and kids. And since they're already used to eating grain on a regular basis, it's already a big part of their diet. That helps reduce the stress because they're also not going through a big change in their diet. They're just kind of removing milk from the diet. The other thing that can help reduce stress is what's called fence line weaning, which is a little bit more common sometimes in cattle, but it means that you separate the kids and the lambs from their moms, but they're in a pasture right next to one another. They're still able to see a fence, or they're still able to see one another, just mm-hmm. they just have a fence in between them. Yeah. For sheep and goats, the one thing that's very important about fence line weaning is to make sure there are no holes in that fence.
Yeah.
Because lambs and kids are pretty good about finding any holes.
Clever little.
So if it's not a secure fence and you fence line wean, they could sneak back through and be right back in with their moms the next morning. But being able to still be close and see one another is another way to help reduce stress.
And I say the diet should not be changed drastically 2 weeks before. You want to get your vaccinations and other management tasks performed at least 2 weeks prior. What are some of the management tasks that you want to make sure get done before you?
Yes, management tasks could be tagging those kids, especially when it comes to record keeping. If you tag them when they're still with their moms, that helps reduce stress. And then also, you know for sure who their mom is. And then other management tasks would be weathering any males, so castration, because that's another stressful event.
As if they didn't have enough to worry about.
Yeah. And then vaccinations. Those aren't very stressful. It's just a little like poke of a needle, just like when we get shots. Mm-hmm. But CD&T vaccinations or Covaxin 8. Helps prevent lambs and kids from overeating disease, and that's important for them to have before weaning, so they can help build those antibodies against it, especially if they haven't been creep fed and they're gonna go to more of a grain based diet, because they really like grain just like we like dessert, and they tend to overeat it sometimes.
All right, why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the weaning process that the kids and the lambs have to go through. We're talking with Davin Skrantz from K-State Extension. Later, we'll talk to James Cooper about bread and flour and all that kind of stuff that we all like, with butter and jam and stuff like that, as we continue here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. 7:54, about 6 minutes away from 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning here at the mighty 690 KGGF. Dave and Scrance, James Cooper, our guests here from K-State Extension. And with Dave, we've been talking about the weaning of little kids, little lambies, Mary'sy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddly divey too, wouldn't you? That's way too old for either of you. All right, David, what other considerations do we need to keep in mind, management considerations? You mentioned the disease. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that.
Overeating disease is the easy way to say it.
There we go. I suffer from that.
Yeah. And the other one is coccidiosis, which is more of a parasite they can get. And that's just because this time of year, parasites really love this wet, warm weather.
Sure, why not?
And then when lambs and kids are kind of a little stressed from weaning, parasites take that opportunity to really thrive if they're able to.
Like to pile on, make an uncomfortable situation even more so.
Yeah, so you want to be aware of that. And with coccidiosis, that specific type of bacteria and parasite, you can add, it's called a coccidiostatin to the feed or the water, and basically it's just a medication to help treat or prevent coccidiosis. So that's okay. Another precaution you can take.
All right, I imagine you guys have all sorts of publications and websites for the uninitiated, somebody who wants to know more about these things, or even if you are an expert in this matter, resources to look at to help you through these tough times of weaning. Can you tell us where we can find some of those?
Yeah, so our Facebook page is Wildcat Extension District, and our website is linked on that. You can also contact me at the office as well. That number is 620-331-2690. And we have a website as well, but I don't have our website address memorized. If you search Wildcat Extension District K-State, something like that, it should come up, and then you can find all of our resources linked there as well.
I always feel a little smarter agricultural-wise after we visit with you cats, because I did not know until today that a mama goat was referred to as a doe. I always thought it was just a mama goat. But ewes, I understood, because, you know, everybody knows that. But you mentioned in your notes here that recently weaned ewes and does should not be turned out to lush pasture. Why is that?
Yeah, great question. That's because after does and ewes wean their kids, they have to dry up their milk supply.
Yeah.
And being turned out onto really nice, lush pasture,
it's not going to help in that.
Exactly. Because usually that nice, lush pasture is more nutrient rich, which is great. But you want to kind of limit those good nutrients, because that will help them to dry up their milk supply quicker with less chance of mastitis.
Right.
So wait a few weeks before turning them out on that pasture.
Yeah, the mama sheep, the mama goat, their brain is going to say, this is for the baby. And the next thing you know, you've got problems there.
Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned that by the time weaning occurs, females should be, as you said, consuming a low-quality forage diet. What would that generally consist of? Just poor pasture, or
it could just be the normal pasture that they've been on, or if they're getting hay, if they're not on pasture and you've been feeding them, for example, alfalfa hay, a more nutrient rich hay, then just switching them from alfalfa to grass. If they've been on it, then you can just leave them on it. Maybe if they've been getting grain, remove the grain from their diet. You just don't want to increase the nutrient quality of their feed until after they've dried up. And then if, for example, one needs to gain a little bit weight once her milk has dried up, then that's a great time to increase their feed quantity and or quality.
Well, it's an important point, an important place in the time of the life of the lifespan of the baby sheep, the baby goat, the weaning. They can just get separate from the mom, live their own little goat, their little sheep lives, and live long and prosper. Dave, and thanks for being with us. And of course, you'll stick around here for the next half hour as we talk with James Cooper about flour, bread, pasta, pastries, and all things gluten. If you have a gluten intolerance, don't worry about it. You can't get problems by listening to it, but that's what we're going to be talking about as we continue here on a Wednesday morning on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Almost 12 minutes after 8 o'clock, Wednesday morning at the Mighty 690 KGGF. I'm Bill Small, joined by our friends from K-State. Earlier, we were chatting with Dave and Scrantz, and she's basically hipped us to everything we need to know on a casual or semi-serious basis about weaning the baby goats and the baby sheeps. And I was today years old when I realized that mama goats were referred to as does. So you listen, you learn, and that goes for your host as well. We've got James Cooper here to talk to us now about the upcoming wheat harvest and why that's so important, as if it weren't obvious enough to me anyway, because I like bread. I like pastries. I like pasta. I like, if you can make it out of wheat, I pretty much like it. But when is the harvest actually starting, James?
Well, right now we're what we call coloring is basically, you know, when the wheat starts to get its nice amber golden color.
Amber waves of grain.
Yeah, amber waves of grain. And so right now we're pretty close to getting towards the end on the early varieties on that. So if it dries out sometime next week.
Maybe.
I mean, they'll be harvesting. I mean, really, it's not far away, and putting our double crop soybeans in right behind it. So we are right on the very edge if we get some dry weather.
Well, you can't have flour without wheat, and for the many different kinds of wheat, there are many different kinds of flour as well.
Yep. And so today I kind of want to talk about all things flour, you know, in celebration of our impending wheat harvest. And so, you know, there are all kinds of flour, and there's all kinds of wheat. Mm-hmm. I mean, that make all kinds of flour.
Yeah, for me, so, you say wheat, and I'm thinking, okay, wheat. I did not know that there were so many different varieties.
Oh, there's a ton of them, quantity, right? Yeah, of classes, even. I mean, the actual varieties are hundreds, really. But even classes of those varieties that they kind of fit into. And so, mostly around here, we grow winter wheat. Mm-hmm. That's what people think of most of the time when they think wheat. We plant in the fall. It grows over the winter, harvest it.
Hence the name.
Spring. Yes. 75% of the wheat in the U.S. is winter wheat. Spring wheat, like it says,
you plant it in the spring. Yeah,
and then you harvest it late summer, early fall. That's mostly done in the northern states. It just gets too hot here too fast for us to do any spring wheat. So we don't get very good yields on it. We also have hard red winter wheat. There's both red and white wheat as well. And so there's classifications within that classifications as well. And we also have soft wheat and we have hard wheat too. And so there's, I mean, a number of different types. And we have a whole nother type called Durum, which doesn't even fit in any of those other categories. And so, you know.
But it makes some nice spaghetti.
Yes, it makes the spaghetti.
Yeah.
The soft wheat has less protein in it, and so that's the gluten pretty much that holds everything together. So cookies, cakes, crackers, those are the kind of stuff that we make out of the soft wheat,
right.
And we use a lot of it here in the U.S. We're probably the country that uses the most soft wheat.
We eat the most cookies and cakes.
We like cookies around here. Yeah. So soft wheat, it has around 8 to 12% protein. And so it's pretty low on that protein scale, pretty much means the gluten scale there.
Well, who eats a cookie for the protein is what I say.
Yeah. So, you know, even with that protein, the gluten doesn't have a lot else in it. The hard wheats is the stuff that we make into bread.
Right.
So, I mean, we're talking about 12-15% protein when we come to that
case. Is there a difference in the protein, in the not the protein, but the kind of wheat that's used for like the white bread and the rye and the like the sawdust kind of bread that some folks like? Yeah.
So, I mean, when you're talking about rye, you're talking about spelt and, you know, a lot of the other ones, you're actually talking about a completely different plant.
Mm.
And it's a mixture of rye and or something else that goes in with it that they kind of divvy out the flour a little bit and make a different kind of product.
When I was a kid, you know, nothing other than Wonder Bread, you know, just a soft melt in your mouth. But now that I'm a grown up and I like a nice stiff rye or a wheat bread or those like specialty breads that you see, you know, I love those. It's just that the flavor of them.
There's like dozens of different, you know, grass related species that you can mix in with bread and create all kinds of things.
Try not to think about you eating grass.
Potatoes and all kinds of stuff. When it comes to that, there's also kind of some differences in protein between the whites and the reds as well. As the name implies, white is actually a whiter wheat. The berry.
I figured there was a reason for calling it that.
Yeah. It's not, you know, it's just kind of.
Not a marketing thing. Keep them separate. Yeah,
farmers see
folks' minds.
But also, the reds actually do have a stronger flavor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that brand in there is stronger. It's a little more bitter. It's actually kind of, you know, like the crust of wheat.
Right.
It's kind of bitter. And so, in general, the reds do have a higher protein than soft, but or whites. But the soft and hard is still the biggest difference.
Okay.
I mean, that's really how we divide out our protein percentages.
Let me step back for just a second because I think we may have glossed over durum wheat. Now, I loves my Italian foods.
Uh-huh.
And what is it about durum wheat that makes it so preferable for the creation of pasta dishes?
Yes. And so durum wheat is still a high protein wheat. So,
right.
I mean, it's still 14-15%, kind of the same as bread wheat, really, in the high end. But durum wheat, it's kind of a little bit different in that it's kind of really hard, really. And so it takes a lot more grinding to make it, to grind it into flour. And during that process, it actually damages the starches.
Mm-hmm.
And so it rises less than other wheat does. And because it rises less, we don't really want a whole lot of rising in our pasta. We don't make fluffy pasta. We want hard, dense pasta.
Nobody's ever asked for a nice fluffy lasagna.
Yeah, don't want fluffy lasagna. And so, but besides that, it also stretches really well.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of good stretch because you got to make that thin little pasta, but without the rising. And so durum wheat really fits well within that category because of its natural component and also because it takes so much more grinding. To make it happen. And so we pretty much use durum wheat almost exclusively in pasta.
Mm.
I mean, and so really when you're seeing that, and even when you're seeing like whole wheat pasta or something like sometimes you'll see that brown
one. I've never enjoyed whole wheat pasta.
Yeah, it's a little bit more bitter.
And it's crunchier.
And that's because they're grinding the whole berry.
I like a nice El Dante. Was it El Dante? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm looking over to Brian as if he'll know. I like it, you know, to just boil up the noodles until they just yield a little bit to the bite. I don't like mushy pasta. But whole wheat pasta, you just never can get that al dente. That's the word. You just can never get that al dente finish on it.
Yeah. So it takes more because it's... And actually, I was going to talk about what's in the flour part.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah. And so, you know, because it's putting the whole berry in there, you're getting all parts to it. And so that brand... is still in that pasta.
My innards might like it, but my mouth doesn't.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, you just brought up the different kinds of wheat make the different types of flour.
Yes, yeah. And so there's, of course, all different types of wheat, all different types of flour.
Mm-hmm.
All-purpose flour is usually what most people use. And that's kind of a misnomer. I'm not terribly fond of all-purpose flour because of that. And so usually it's around 80% hard wheat and 20% soft wheat or some sort of mixture.
Right.
That's kind of the issue, is that it can be some sort of mixture.
It can be this, it can be that, it could be 80-20, it could be 70-30, who knows?
You don't know. And so bread flour, that's 100% hard wheat.
Right.
And so it's got a really high protein content, really high gluten content, really make that nice, firm, you know, big, fluffy bread. Cake flour is 100% soft wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the exact opposite of that. It has a lower protein because you don't want all that cohesiveness within your cakes. You don't want dense cakes.
We want tasty cakes.
Yeah, we want big fluffy ones.
Yes. Not fluffy lasagna, fluffy cakes.
Pastry flour is kind of the inverse of all-purpose flour, in that it's 20% hard and 80% soft, or a close mixture to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because you want a little bit of hardness to your pastries, a little bit like bread. But all of these contain just the endosperm part of the berry.
And what is the endosperm?
So when you have a little wheat berry or corn or really anything, honestly, that's kind of the big lump of starch
right.
that's in there.
Yeah.
And so it's the carbohydrate reserve of that seed.
Mm-hmm.
The germ part is that little bitty piece that's connected onto it that the plant actually comes from.
Right.
So it germinates from that little tiny piece and it feeds off the endosperm.
Okay.
Then you have the last part, which is the bran, and that is the outer casing to whatever berry that is. And, you know, that's the brown part and kind of fibrous.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a lot of your nutrients from the fiber of that bran or from the germen part. The endosperm doesn't really have a whole lot of nutrients in it, honestly. And so our bread flour doesn't have a whole lot in it besides, you know, carbohydrates, starches.
Which we enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of this stuff is also bleached as well. A lot of these flours are. Basically, we treat them with a sort of peroxide, a benzoid peroxide, or even chlorine, actually. And so it takes out the carotenoids, which is the brown part, too.
Right.
So that way we have a really nice
Because if you want a nice white bread, you want a white bread. You don't want a brown bread.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it also makes the dough less sticky, oddly enough. And so it's easier to work with when you're making bread. And so, you know, when we do that, actually, when we, in the big flour mills, they end up with a lot of mids.
Mm-hmm.
And mids is pretty much another name for bran and the germ part. And we actually feed that to livestock. And so when she was talking about goats and the free range, we make it into little pellet cakes.
Here you go, kids. Here's your pellet cake. Leave mama alone.
We feed all that the stuff that the nutrient stuff that we aren't eating, and we feed it to our animals. So they're eating.
And then we eat the animals, so it's all good.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so we give them more nutrients than we eat sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the one that is different though is whole wheat flour. And actually, there's some labeling misnomers to that. You kind of actually get something that says 100% whole wheat flour. It's got to be brown. I mean, you know, there are some ways that they kind of trick with those words. But that is actually the ground endosperm, the ground germ, the bran, everything. It's all mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hence all parts
whole
of the
wheat.
Berry.
Yeah.
Yeah, whole wheat. And, you know, it's generally made from hard wheat for the most part because, you know, the processing is different. And, I mean, that's just like you would expect. I mean, it's not going to rise as well. You got to treat it a little bit differently. It doesn't have that gluten content. It's not going to make it nice, soft as bread as well. So you got to be prepared for that. But it does actually have more fiber and nutrients in it. So a lot of people like it. But it does have a little more bitter taste, too, because of that brand is in there. And so, like what was gonna the before I was talking about durum wheat.
Right.
You can make bread out of durum wheat, but it doesn't rise very well. Mm-hmm. So
spaghetti bread.
Yeah, spaghetti bread.
I guess the bottom line is to make sure if you're gonna do any baking, get the right flour for what it is you want to make.
Yes. In my personal opinion, that's the big thing about all-purpose flour. Is that it varies greatly from brand to brand. You don't actually know what your gluten percentage is, your protein percentage. But if you make a cake or if you make a bread out of bread flour versus cake flour, I mean, those two different protein percentages, it becomes very obvious the difference between those two. So if you're going to go to the effort of making bread, which most people don't do nowadays. I don't know.
Maybe I enjoy it. I used to have a bread maker. I used to love messing around with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, getting the right flour is it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fairly cheap investment for what the effort you're putting into it because it really does actually make a better bread. And the same thing with your cake as well. And so that getting that lower protein percentage, it doesn't make your cake near as hard. Mm-hmm. It really gives a nice fluffy cake. So I think protein percentage really is important. And all-purpose flour, you don't quite know what you're getting.
Yeah.
Really.
Do they label it to where you can...
Not always.
Not always.
They don't always put the caveat emptor, protein in there. Yeah. And so, you know, I assume that probably the more cheaper generic brands will likely have a lower protein percentage. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily true because they're just going to get whatever's available, whatever's cheap. Generally, soft wheat is cheaper just because it's, you know, the yield content and all that. And so... You know, we usually get our bread from the flour from the Amish, actually. We we live pretty close to them.
Yeah.
And so they have really cheap and huge bags of flour. And it's actually pretty good flour. So
now you mentioned, and just to, so we can sum up here, you mentioned that this is one of the few areas where you will see hard and soft wheat growing side by side.
Yes, yes. And so this is one of the very few places in the country that we grow soft wheat and hard wheat side by side.
Yeah.
It's rarely done. Usually in the east they grow the soft wheat, in the north they grow the hard wheat. Here it mixes together. If you see a field without awns, like the little spiky things on top, that's usually soft wheat around here. The varieties can be different, but that's usually what we got. So
just gets too hot too fast is what you're saying.
Yeah. But you know, soft wheat and hard wheat, it kind of grows pretty much the exact same, honestly, until you get makes a head. So
now I want a sandwich.
Yeah.
Followed by some spaghetti. All right. Thanks, James Cooper and Dave and Scrounce for getting us up to date on the ewes and the goats and the weaning and everything. K-State, thanks for joining us here this morning on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Have a prosperous day.
Yeah,
thanks for having us.
You bet. Next time.